we have a diagnostic that's honestly, it's a 30-minute conversation with kind of key players within an organization. And I've asked the same questions thousands of times, which is, what's your origin story? How are you here? Why are you here in this organization? What brought you into the organization? What's your greatest aspiration for the future? And what will hold you back? Meaning as an organization. And how, what's interesting about that is that it means that within a very short spate of conversations, we can come back and say, everyone sort of agrees that this is the thing that's holding you back. Everyone sort of agrees this is the place you want to go. And so often being able to be like, hey, let's think about where we want to go together first. What do we want to create first? Allows us then to come back into the room to say, well, how do we commit to each other? How do we actually kind of commit to that change? Too often we lead with the diagnosis as opposed to kind of lead with like, this can probably help. Let's try this first. You can actually solve a lot without having to kind of diagnose and kind of tell somebody that they're really bad at something by just giving them the tools that make them better at things.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Heart Management. When the pandemic hit, I was really afraid that we would hear countless stories of leaders who took short-sighted decisions to keep doing business as usual without adequately addressing the fears and concerns that almost everyone was feeling, and that as a result, we would see a steep loss of trust in leadership. I'm sure that there are many examples like that, but I'm really glad to say that according to the anecdotal evidence of my conversations with a significant number of HR professionals and leaders, and from the studies that I've looked at, it seems like leaders very often stepped up, ready to show vulnerability, and that trust as a result rose. However, as we are now taking steps into this new post-pandemic normal in many parts of the world, it seems to me like many organizations are struggling with how to have trusting and constructive internal conversations about how and where they do their best work. And as a result, internal trust in leadership seems to be shaken. An essential foundation for a healthy culture, and as you know, on this podcast, we're all about healthy culture, is an organization's ability to have hard and important conversations that can move us forward. Whether it's about critical ethics and values dilemmas, what we need to address in our culture, or how we can collaborate to solve our stakeholders' problems, our ability to have these conversations matter immensely. And I'm sure many of you know and have experience of these conversations not happening or not at all going as intended. I can't think of a better person to have this conversation and discuss conversations with than Fred Dust. Fred works at the intersection of business, society, and creativity. He was for 20 years a global managing partner at the acclaimed and iconic design studio IDEO, known for advancing design thinking and designing things like Apple's first computer mouse. Fred is really passionate about designing creative conversations to solve big problems. And that has included guiding the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to help students make better decisions about paying for college, helping the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation create new frameworks to better engage their stakeholders, or supporting the Greek government during the financial crisis in 2010. Fred is the author of Making Conversation: Seven Essential Elements of Meaningful Communication. And I wanted to give a shout out to my friend, Professor Mary Gentile, who has introduced me to Fred and his incredible work. But now, without further ado, let's jump into this conversation with Fred Dust. So, Fred, it is such an honor to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm excited for the conversation. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I'll jump straight into your really insightful book, Making Conversation, where you write that conversations that matter are about grappling with hard issues. These conversations will often be about strategy, political issues, or emotionally charged topics. And I almost have to pause and breathe there, because I just feel like right now there are so many hard conversations. But so many.
It's really true. Definitely breathe. Do a lot of breathing. It's one of the things we need to do.
So true. And I'm thinking as we're speaking to leaders, HR, and ethics professionals, I'm sure if we look at a bigger kind of societal perspective, I mean, there are lots of conversations to be had, and I'm sure perhaps in our among our relatives and families as well. But if we think about the professional setting and the context, what are some of the conversations that you think about that kind of we need to design, and that are these type of hard conversations that should take us forward?
It's a great question, and it's really got me thinking, because it's like, I want to not say all of them, but I will say that we should be looking at all of them pretty closely, because I think that there's a lot of questions I have around kind of like so much of what we take to be implicit in those conversations. I'm going to call it a couple that I think are really critical. One that I kind of talk about all the time, one that's just occurred to me this morning, but one that I often look at is any conversations where you're offering critique, and how you begin to think about how to balance critique and recognize that in a moment of critique, one of you has power, one of you doesn't. And so what I often try to do is look at how we can actually reestablish the rules so that we can actually kind of, in essence, pass the power. So Tobias, if I'm giving you critique, often what I would do if I was in this mode is basically stop and say, are there things that you can't talk about today? Are there things you don't want to talk about? Are there things you really feel like you want to focus on? Which actually basically gives you the power to say, these are the things that I can't discuss today. You know, these are things I can't grapple with. But before you hand it back for me to kind of like do that. So that's a very fundamental, that one that I think we get wrong all the time. And it's not just critique of behavior. It's critique of ideas. It's critique of work. It's like we're a little free and easy with this notion. And I think it's something that we really have to work on. But a question that I've been asking, we're preparing for an event next week in Aspen. And one of the questions I've been really asking, and we're going to get this in small groups to get people to kind of ask this question, which is like, what am I good at? And what can I really help with? And where actually am I not that helpful? And where might it be easier and better for me not to be part of the conversation? So one of the things I'm really looking at are, how do we start to kind of really assess where are the places where, yes, you, Tobias, should be in a conversation, and where actually maybe it's better off if you let that conversation go and know that it's going to be in good hands around that. And so that's a conversation I'm really interested in having us think a bit more. I think we're not that good at sort of saying, why might I be in a room, or why might I not be in a room? And I think that's a conversation I feel like would be worthwhile getting better at over time.
That is so fascinating. I was really surprised by both answers, but they make a lot of sense. And I think this first part of critique is such an important thing to grapple with. And we had, I think, two episodes ago, we had Megan Wrights, who's a researcher on speaking up and creating a culture of listening. And we also had a lot of conversation there about these power dynamics. And I'm so happy that you bring that up, because it is such an important perspective. And of course, also in not just in the sense of speaking up, but also in the sense of critiquing somebody's work or somebody's ideas. And I'm thinking about something else. And you and I, we talked about a shared friend of ours, Mary Gentile, whose work I think has been very influential on both of us. And she's written the book Giving Voice to Values, and really started a movement around that and around her research around that. And I'm just thinking that perhaps another type of conversation that is hard are those kind of values dilemmas that organizations face, where we don't necessarily want to talk about them. We want to talk about what feels inspiring and happy, but where we have these dilemmas in terms of we say something, we do something different, or where we have a conflict of values or a conflict of targets in that sense, that we say we should value this, but actually we're measuring and on this, and that's what we're actually kind of going for. Or let's say, for example, in a public organization, I know it looks a bit different in Sweden than in the US, but let's say that you have a certain budget set, and at the same time, you should give a certain amount of care to your patients, for example. And there are some really, really hard conversations in terms of where do we set the limits of the care that we give, true dilemmas, and I just wanted to kind of ask you in terms of how do you look at those type of conversations from the perspective of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting example, and I think it kind of relates to one of the things that I was kind of pondering on this morning that made me kind of think about where should we be involved in something, where should we kind of cut ourselves out, is that I'm really interested in what I'm thinking about as collective discernment, which is like, so there's discernment, which is like, I look at something and I understand it, or I think I understand it. And how does that work? And what I'm really trying to kind of look at now with some of our work is, how do we do that collectively? And do we do it better collectively, or do we do it better individually? So when, for instance, is a moral or ethical question or values question easier to answer for you, Tobias, versus for us, you and I, Tobias? You know, so it's like, so how do we actually kind of get to that kind of collective conversation? And so one of the things that I'm actually really trying to do with people is first just practice collective discernment, just like basic stuff. Like, can we agree that these two things are true? Let's look at this and really kind of get there before we start getting into kind of more sophisticated or complex things. Like, when should we be considering end of life care, right? Is it really, that's one of the biggest, you know, kind of questions to have. And so I think it's one of the things that we don't do is we don't practice on the easy stuff before we, or even the things that we assume would be easy before we jump to the hard stuff. We just go to the hard stuff. And that's to our own detriment over and over and over again. Like, and you know this from Mary's work, you kind of need to practice. It's just what needs to happen. So it's just, I think that we don't, but you don't practice on the hard stuff, practice on easier things, then get to the hard stuff.
That is so, so helpful. And I hear in that as well, of course, I'm so, so excited to dig soon in our conversation, to dig into the framework that you have created around this, because I just thought about this perspective of making sure that we kind of can agree on some facts. And I think it's something that we often maybe miss along the way. So we're talking with so many different definitions, understandings, and facts. And we have had Susan Lattaud, who's also an ethics researcher, and she started a class at Stanford after actually the 2016 election, when there was a talk about alternative facts. So she started a class there to really focused on that there are no alternative facts. We have to actually be able to talk about truth, and that there is something like truth that we need to be able to agree on.
So interesting, because it's a question I'm asking myself right now, which is, I mean, one of the things we're looking at a lot is folklore, mythology, urban legend, legend in general, and the roles that kind of the different truths folklore might have at different eras, right? So what did it mean to have a certain kind of myth or folklore in the 1950s versus the 1980s versus now, and how do we reinterpret? So I'm really interested in actually sometimes playing around with more nebulous places where it's not even fact. It's like, well, we, you know, this is a myth that we tell ourselves so that we don't go swimming after eating, you know, whatever. And what's the role that plays, you know, in terms of that, and why do we have that? So I'm so interested in this topic and the nuance of how easy it is to slip into us believing that we know facts when we haven't even analyzed it ourselves sometimes.
So true. And I think that like connects with something that is so fundamental to culture, which is the assumptions that we have. The assumptions we have about how what leads to success within this group and so on. And as you point out, I mean, those assumptions can easily masquerade as facts. And based on those assumptions, we can be really, really stuck in a way of thinking that that's not gonna lead us forward. And I think there's another conversation that I think a lot of our listeners have been having over these last perhaps year. And I think it's a conversation of how we do our best work and where we do our best work. And of course, we see now a lot of organizations that land in different places. We had Elon Musk recently tweeting that, or writing to his employees, that everyone's going to go back to the office. We have others saying that, like, work however you want, wherever you want, like Airbnb, for example. And I don't want to debate what is right or wrong, because I mean I've basically chosen not to have much opinion on that. But what I've really found interesting is that I think when the pandemic started, and I said this in the intro to this podcast, that there were a lot of, I was afraid that we're going to see a lot of examples of leaders who didn't at all like listen to or care for the needs of their people. But I think we saw that, but we also saw a lot of examples of the opposite. I think we saw a lot of examples of where trust was built and where people actually did the right thing in so many cases. But then after the pandemic, I found that many organizations have found themselves in a place where they don't really have the foundation to have a trusting conversation about how do we do our best work. And suddenly, from that high trust, trust is suddenly shaking and the conversations are falling apart. Why is it so hard for us to have these conversations?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing. And I'll give you a kind of funny consequence, which is that right as we were kind of getting to final edits of the book, we went into pandemic, we went into the quarantine, and my publisher reached out and was like, you need to quickly write a chapter on how we have the hardest conversations of our life during a pandemic in over Zoom. And what I kind of did, and I adapted the kind of 7 C's that are in the book, I basically was like, well, how do we actually start to understand this for all the different workflows that we have? And so one of the things that we started to do, I built like 5 ideas, which were basically like, know that you're committed to a conversation and know the ones that you actually kind of like need to be in it, and then don't go to the ones that you don't, kind of the conversation that we were having a little bit earlier. But then things like, what mediums are best for what kinds of work? So when is working in a Google Doc good enough that you don't need to be in person? And then what mediums are necessary where you need to be in person? What are the conversations where something really requires us to be together? So one of the things I think people are getting wrong right now is it makes no sense to me to have everybody come into the office only to do Zoom meetings with people outside of the office, right? It feels like what we need to do is start to say, what's the medium? And in this case, the office, the workplace, is a medium, and say, what really works for that? And then what are the things that work great in other places? When does it work better, Tobias, if I pick up the phone and just call you? You know, I think critique is a great example where sometimes it's easier to do that when you're not face-to-face, when you're doing things in that context. And then what are the things where, no, absolutely, we need to be together? And I would say hard cultural conversations, to your point, where values are at the stake or at the heart of them, those are places where you need to kind of think about what being together lets us do. So I wish we'd go away from the question of do we go back or don't we, but more like what do we go back for and what is just perfectly fine not going back for. And I think that's kind of where we need to be moving these conversations.
I wanted to like think a bit more about like having the conversation about how we have conversations in terms of like how leaders and employees, where I found that sometimes they find themselves in different places in this conversation with different opinions. Someone wants people to get back into the office, somebody doesn't. And that's where I feel like there's something with those conversations that I've seen in a number of organizations that they doesn't feel like they have been really that constructive.
Yeah, no, and it's a shame, because I think that to your point earlier, one of the things that we saw early in the pandemic was in essence a kind of humanizing. And one of the things that we saw were like, you know, employees suddenly seeing their bosses having to grapple with what it meant to take care of their children and have to deal with a dog. You know, it's like things that like, so we humanized ironically, in a way that we might not have imagined, because we're seeing into each other's lives, into it in a deeper way. And I think we kind of let that go. And I think the question really there is like, is how do we wear multiple hats for a moment? Like, so just what's interesting is there are CEOs who probably would be as afraid or at risk as coming back to the office as there are employees, right? So it's like, when do you look at something from a human level and sort of say, let's have this conversation as humans first, then let's have conversations as employees first, then let's have conversations as a company. You know, so it's almost like trying on different layers of the conversation. It's kind of what we were saying before, it's practicing. Well, let's understand, Tobias, what you and I need. Then let's understand what like you and I and blank need. And then let's understand what like the, so it's kind of zeroing out as opposed to just kind of going to the conversation. I also will say that we're not helped by the fact that we've just continually made dictates that we continually back up from. Like, well, basically like we're gonna go back to the office. No, we're not gonna go back to the office. It just feels like we might be better off acknowledging that we're living in a very in-between moment. And that kind of, you know, blanket statement just doesn't hold well for anybody right now. But I do think it's like, it's that practice. It's like, it's go to the individual, go then to the small collective, go bigger from there.
I really, really love that. And I, for everyone listening, I think that is such great advice to actually break down the conversation into these different perspectives and to have, because then you don't mix the hats and mix the terms kind of, you're actually all putting on the hat of our kind of humanity and then on of the team and then of the organization and everyone has to do that and you have those conversations. I think that is super helpful. So if you are grappling with these conversations, I think really take that to heart. I think that's such great advice.
Can I actually throw out one more thing that I will just kind of like maybe say to people, given that my background was in architecture. And when I started working in design, most of the work I was doing was with technology companies that were trying to figure out how to not have workplaces all the time. So the idea of doing hybridic work where you're sometimes together, sometimes not. This has actually been the holy grail of workplaces for like 25 years. It's been what people have been trying to go to. And I think it's ironic that we sort of stepped away from that and recognized that we actually might have been forced someplace that we've all been trying to design our way to for so long. And then how do we actually begin to acknowledge that and work from there as well? So that's just a more tactical kind of like, hey guys, we've been wanting to do this for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to learn a little bit about your work and we're gonna go into the seven C's, but you worked for 18 years at the really iconic design firm IDEO and you were a global managing director there and you also tell in your book kind of these stories of, for example, when you met with George Papandreou, the prime minister of Greece and kind of these things that shifted your perspective in terms of the role of conversations and how you can actually have conversations that I'll just quote you because I think this is such a great quote. You write that to redesign our social structures, we would in turn have to redesign its core working tool, the conversation itself. And I just wanted to ask you kind of through these experiences at IDEO, for example, with the Greek prime minister and other examples of what you worked with, could you just take any of those examples and just share a little bit about what your work looked like and what you were learning?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a couple examples. And one thing I think I'll say is that one of the things that actually really initially attracted me to IDEO was that it looked to me like an equitable conversation in the sense that people with different experiences, different kinds of backgrounds were coming together and valuing each other's experience. One thing I will also say is that there was a lot of stuff that was inequitable in that, as in any cultural context. And so I do want to acknowledge that equity looked very different, I think at that point. But what's interesting to me is that that sort of became the premise. So I come from a practice that's incredibly hierarchical. If you're an architect, it's like you're the boss. You tell the clients what to do. The clients kind of, you fight with the clients, like you hide things from clients. And basically I came in being like, I want to turn that on its head. Like, I feel like building something, whatever it is, a strategy, a building, whatever those things are, it should be the most exciting conversation that we have as a collective. And I wanted people who were coming together to think about that, to think that it was the most exciting thing they were doing. You only get to set a five-year strategy once every 5 years. You only get to build a building once every, 20 years, if you know, depending who you are. So really think about people's voices in that conversation. So applied that to kind of very hard design, space design. And a lot of it was actually our initial work was in healthcare, where, tremendously divided context. It's like the administration versus the nurses versus the doctors became this kind of versus the patients became a really interesting thing. And having to kind of look how to break those barriers, which, by the way, is a really interesting example where it's like you started to do it by saying, well, let's start with the people who are right on in the face of it the most. And that was nurses. We worked with RNs the most because they were the interface between care and administration and doctors. And so they had the most kind of knowledge base of how to kind of begin to think of how to solve for patients, but also think about the context they were in. So much of the work, like redesigning hospital spaces, was getting that conversation to work, to live collectively, to feel like the nurses on the floor were actually designers, to feel like the doctors were part of the design. So that turns out to have been very applicable when you start to think about governmental conversations as well, or societal conversations. So that's actually kind of what I learned when I started to work with George Papandreou, is like, wait, these tools, they're not that different, and they actually really are needed. And if we start to think about the design of conversation, which is very embedded in Greek culture, given that it's like in many ways, at least Western conversation, Western structures came from the ancient Greek models, then you could start to apply it to the same thing. So really got to end up doing that by sort of saying, how do we do that with officials in the White House? How do we do that with the Surgeon General and the public? One of my favorite kind of multiple year projects was with now Senator Elizabeth Warren, when she ran a thing called Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that was a conversation really between her group and the American public in terms of understanding what people needed protection from, where they needed to go. And so really starting to think about the conversation being the design problem, the conversation being the thing that we needed to apply creativity to, not necessarily always just the thing. So the work just ranged so wildly, and I'm endlessly thankful for the fact that I got to kind of play all over the spectrum and still do. It's a fascinating, fun moment to be doing. Well, fun, and as you acknowledged, hard moment to do this.
Yeah.
Well, but it's great. There's some things, yeah, where fun isn't the first thing that I'm like, whoa, this is so fun.
I guess it's like, to say the least, I guess it's a privilege, and that's what I feel as well when you get to be a part of work that feels really, really meaningful. I'm just thinking in terms of these conversations that you describe, and let's take the hospital, that I think those polarizations are so typical, and I think anyone who has an experience, with the hospital administration knows that those are there. But we see them in if you work with a university, you have them between researchers and support staff, and you have them lots of different and polarizations. And of course, as you talk about it, as you talk about building a hospital and the importance of actually letting the people be part of the design, it sounds so obvious. It sounds so, of course, you should do that. And don't we always do that? But yet, we don't. And I'm just thinking in terms of if you could take another example of where, like, what that practically looked like, kind of in engaging and involving people in a way that they were not necessarily involved before, or that they are not usually involved.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a couple things, and I want to kind of maybe make a meta commentary, which is because I think the hospital is a really great example of something that we're all living with now in our day-to-day life that we saw very clearly when I was working in the healthcare context, which is that one of the things that's led to our inability to kind of process and have the kinds of hard conversations we have is because we live in a kind of crisis mindset. So whatever we're feeling that day is whatever's happened this morning in the news hook, right? So it's like a shooting happened or the stock market fell or whatever, and we're living with that. And yet we don't give ourselves time to process that. In fact, we just don't, we don't value kind of taking the time to sort of say, what if we slow down and reflect on what just happened here? I will say this, Tobias, which is like, I was reflecting with my people that after the shooting, the school shooting in Texas, I marveled at the fact that as a culture, everybody just went back to work. No other culture that I can think of would say, back to work, everybody, like, you know, minutes after something like that. And yet we did it. And it's like, and so that's, and that's a macrocosm of what I was sort of saying that I think is interesting in the healthcare context, where it's like, it's trauma upon trauma, it's upon trauma. One of the things that really is hard for nurses and doctors say is that they're living in a place where they can't always fix the problem, and what they can't lash out at the patient, so they lash out at each other. You know, it's this kind of lateral violence. It's kind of, it's bullying. So what we really look to is to kind of begin to sort of like to begin to solve for that. It's a lot. I mean, so there's really simple things that we would do, which is like really ask people to lose expert language and lose jargon and lose all the kind of things that make us feel like we're really smart about something, but instead be like, let's talk at the most human level. So one of the most outlandish things I think I've ever done with a hospital, at least, is asking doctors, administrators, RNs to come together and silently act out what they thought the future of healthcare could be in a minute. Which, if you think about it, takes away everything you have. If you're a surgeon, what do you got in there? If you're a like nurse, what do you have in there? But that was this, first of all, it was a moment of real joy. People really loved it, but also great ideas came out of it. And so that was a really interesting example where it's an extreme example of being like, let's put severe limiters, severe constraints on how this conversation plays out and see what kind of dynamics we get in that room. So an extreme one, but kind of remarkable in terms of like the things that we actually pulled out of it and the kind of bonding it built between the group that had to think about the future of their healthcare system. So really, I'm very interested in the moments where we take away the tools that we get very used to in conversation and replace them with things that may be more uncomfortable for us.
So interesting. And I guess constraints are really sometimes the bedrock of creativity. It releases something. And I want to jump into the framework and you talk about the seven C's, the things that you have found are really crucial in terms of designing. So we're looking at conversations that are not just kind of happening, but there are conversations that we design to actually move us forward, to not just be that we have a talk about something, but that we're actually moving forward, that we're doing it with things that matter. And the first C is for commitment. And you write something that I thought was so interesting, that commitment is not primarily about being committed to our beliefs and ideas as going into the conversation, but being committed to having the conversation. Could you explain that difference for us?
Yeah, and there's a funny little story about that. So when I was writing the book, I did a lecture on what at that point were the six C's of conversation. And I had somebody raise their hand in the audience afterwards and was like, well, what do I do if I hate the person or I hate the ideas and I don't even want to get them into the conversation in the first place? And it was one of those moments where you're on stage and you're like, what do you do? And I realized that commitment was the only way in there. And so what I kind of begin the book with and what I begin most of our work with is that conversation is a long haul, right? We're not going to fix things in an hour. Sometimes we won't fix things in days, weeks, years, right? But in order to actually even enter into the conversation, we first have to feel like we're committed to that conversation. And maybe more importantly, that I'm committed to you. So you're in the conversation and I'm like committing to you as an individual. So I'm learning things right off the bat that are important. What's your name? What matters to you, like those kinds of things that actually are like, let me understand you as a person. And what one of the things that obstructs that is when we have an idea, and this is, forget values for a moment, we often come into a conversation being like, I'm going to change this person's mind. And if you were that person, why would you enter that conversation? Like, what's engaging about that? What's attractive about that? Nothing. And so one of the things that we believe first is that you have to come in being like, I'm committed to having a conversation with you first. whatever my ideas are, whatever the values, whatever those things are, that's in the background. And that may arise or may not in the first conversation, in the first 10 conversations. But if we don't start there, why would you even enter into the conversation? I personally, Tobias, feel like one shouldn't enter conversations where they feel like the people who are hosting those conversations are not committed to me as an individual, or me as a group, or us as a group. We have to feel that people are really there for us. And if you feel like you're not, the people aren't, then it's okay not to go into that conversation, in my mind.
I have so many follow-up questions on that, and I have to be just mindful of time. But one thing I'm thinking, if we have, let's say, in our organization, we have some elephants in the room, or we have some real issues to deal with, and we feel like we have a certain group that are perhaps not really, and let's take an example. Let's say we have an HR leader role in our organization, and we feel that we have a group of leaders. There is a challenge. There is something in their leadership or something in the culture that really needs to be addressed, and they don't necessarily want to talk about that. How do we get that commitment when we know that it is so important that we can create that but we feel like we don't have it from the other side?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do in our work, because one of the things we're often asked to do is come in and fix something. So I'll give you an example that I think is quite funny, but it's an interesting one. So we worked with a company that saw their greatest issue as being politeness, i.e. that the culture was so polite with each other that they would kind of agree about ideas that they didn't agree with while they were in a meeting, just to kind of get through the meeting. And what that meant that was really critical for them is that bad ideas were getting way, way further into the process than they should have. It also meant that people didn't know, like nobody was naming bad ideas. So a really interesting example, right? But the thing is that two things. One is, when we came in, we never said, oh, your problem is politeness, we're going to kind of cure that. It's like, we're more like, let's work on some of these fundamentals, and politeness will happen to be one of those things. So if you work on the idea of critique, then you get to have tools in your hand, skills in your hand, that actually allow you to kind of grapple with the issue of politeness in a different way. So sometimes I think it's easier for us to kind of get people to commit to skills, structures, other things, as opposed to saying, oh, you have a problem with it. Because coming in and saying you have a problem with is the same as kind of not committing to you. It's like, here's your issue, right? But the other thing that we do a lot, we have a diagnostic that's honestly, it's a 30-minute conversation with kind of key players within an organization. And I've asked the same questions thousands of times, which is, what's your origin story? Where did you come from? How are you here? Why are you here in this organization? What brought you into the organization? What's your greatest aspiration for the future? And what will hold you back, meaning as an organization. And what's interesting about that is that it means that within a very short spate of conversations, we can come back and say, everyone sort of agrees that this is the thing that's holding you back. Everyone sort of agrees this is the place you want to go. And so often being able to be like, hey, let's think about where we want to go together first. What do we want to create first? Allows us then to come back into the room to say, well, how do we commit to each other? How do we actually kind of commit to that change? Too often we lead with the diagnosis as opposed to kind of lead with like, this can probably help, let's try this first. You can actually solve a lot without having to kind of diagnose and kind of tell somebody that they're really bad at something by just giving them the tools that make them better at things.
Super helpful. So the second C is creative listening, and I find this one really fascinating. I think listening is one of the areas where we often assume that we are better than what we really are. And actually, in our conversation with Megan Wright, she pointed that out in her research as well. So why is not just regular listening enough? And what does it mean to listen creatively?
Yeah, I think that the way that I kind of got to that, and just to give you a little context, originally I thought the book was almost all going to be about listening. And in fact, the work I'm working on now is actually really expanding the idea of listening and awareness. I think what I was working towards was the idea that every framework we had about listening, everything that we talked about in the world, every time we kind of experienced a leader talking about listening, it was often treating it like work. It was often even punitive, like a leader saying, like, I'm going to just do a listening tour. I'm going to go on, give them a good listening to, or I just have to sit there and listen. Like the language we use around listening is not joyful. There's nothing that makes it feel like it's something that you want to do. Or there's like active listening where we're like, oh, I'm going to listen so Tobias can vent. And that's not the same. That's not me listening. That's just like, oh, let me get his ideas out, you know? Whereas like listening is actually the kind of building block to having a conversation. It's like, it's okay to judge when you listen. It's okay to kind of like call out questions. Like listening doesn't have to be silent. It can be silent, and that's a great thing. But I think we've placed a lot of parameters around what listening looks like in a room versus actually what it feels like when you're doing it and when you're doing it well. So listening should feel like it's sparking joy. It's more interesting. It's like you're learning something. And I also think as a listener, it's fair when that's not happening to stop for a moment and say, wait, let's think about how this can be something that I would enjoy listening to a little bit more. What are the things that we could actually kind of talk about and really ask for the conversations we want to have? So I think the greatest problem for us is that we've gotten listening into kind of like a routine set of tools when it's really the fundamental thing that we do as humans. And it's like what we do if we're good, best, but we often kind of make it sound like hard work that we don't want to do.
I just wanted to ask you, based on that, are we too afraid of silence in our conversations?
100%. And what's interesting about that is like in the research that we did is like, it's often in silence that we get creative synapses that connect things that they wouldn't connect otherwise. Silence is actually, it's really interesting. If you look in spiritual practices, it's used quite well. One of the things that attracted me to George Papandrea's work is how often he would let silence happen, that he would let kind of like people not respond. I feel like we should be building silence in all kinds of ways. One of the things I talk about is if you have an hour meeting, what happens if a 2/3 of the way through you build in a silent 5 minutes where people are just writing their thoughts? And what you can get out of that. It's which is a really interesting tool to kind of get somebody to, hey, we've been talking about this, so what are we going to do about this? But it also allows us to do things in ways, so you may not be as comfortable, Tobias, as I'm as comfortable talking. So it's like, so what happens if you can write your idea for a moment and reflect on it? So let different kinds of thinking pop into the room. I'm a huge fan of doing it.
I think, and I've seen that with so many leaders that I work with, and I've fallen into it so easily myself, that we think that a silence is a void that needs to be filled, and that we don't necessarily kind of take the gift that it gives us, and maybe takes the gift to also see what are the voices in the room that are not being heard, and what are the ideas that are not being said, and so on, and just kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting to kind of think about like how it actually helps you build better decision-making. I think one of the things that's also hard for leaders, for people who are CEOs or whatever, is that they feel that by nature that role needs to be fast and decisive. We think of decisive as being a fast act in the moment they made a decision, whereas like some of the worst decisions I've ever seen or made for that matter have been because I was thinking fast as opposed to kind of stopping for a moment to say, what's the right thing to do here?
So true. So the third C is clarity. And you talk about the need to define the terms, and that in defining the terms, we might get to the root of our different motivations and goals. I think that is so interesting, the idea that we can easily, and I think we talked a bit about that before, that we can easily go into the conversation building out of an assumption or actually having very different motivations, but because we're not clear on what we're talking about and so on. So tell us about creating clarity.
Well, and initially, it's interesting that work came out of the work I did in the healthcare context, where we actually saw places where there were moments of anxiety and fear amongst patients, where healthcare professionals were not very good at translating their kind of jargon or their expert language to language that was understood by the practitioner or the patient. But what was interesting to me as I was working on the book is recognizing that there's like jargon, there's technical terms, there's things like that was kind of where my head was originally in the clarity. But What I also realized is that we take a lot of fundamental concepts, love, values, inspiration, transformation, which is, you know, one that we talk about a lot. It's like, and don't give it the definition that you need to give it. Like, you need to give it a little bit more anchor. So it's a really interesting question to say, if I'm like, oh, I'm looking for inspiration, for you to kind of say, well, what is inspiring to you? What's inspiring to you? Like, to kind of go around, because we might recognize that inspiration looks very different to different people. And so I think that we let terms live sometimes without giving them enough kind of vividness in our mind. So we can actually say, when we're talking about inspiration, we're all talking about this kind of thing, not this kind of thing. It's not the, I'm looking at the landscape inspiration. It's the, this little piece of neuroscientific information about this kind of workflow is really inspiring. And that's really helpful to make sure that we've got our terms aligned before we even think that we can actually create change or make something happen in the world.
And I mean, just based on that, since culture and values and ethics and things like that are very much my world and my professional life, and I think those are things that so often we go into a room and everyone assume that they know what those things are, but if you would really kind of scratch the surface, we're very, very unclear of our terms. What is ethics? What is culture? What are values? And I found that I basically have to start every conversation with defining terms. And that doesn't, I guess it's also important to say, because I think in terms of like culture, for example, that it's not about finding a snappy one sentence definition, because that's actually not helpful. It's just simplifying something to the point where it doesn't mean anything. So I mean, you're correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm just thinking that sometimes it might be kind of co-creating understanding of a concept that is not necessarily that easily described in one sentence.
I love that, Tobias. And I think that what I think is interesting about that is that the point here is that you say to yourself, let's use a word that's a little like community, for instance, which is a word that we often hear, which is, rather than just sort of say, let's define community or let's think about what it is, an easier and better way in is to basically say, when was the last example you had in your life of feeling community? So you can then say, oh, for me, that was in the village square as we were all singing blank, or no, this was actually in the town hall when we did this. And so by giving real examples, people can start to kind of paint a landscape of what community can look like, and then you can begin to build it. And I think we don't want to define words with more words. Let's define words with real examples of things, which then really allow us to kind of anchor our terms in a way that allow us to make change.
Fantastic. So helpful. So the fourth C is context. And you write that context is comprised of the spaces we inhabit and the things in those spaces and the positions we choose to take in that space. And for example, I can think about how leaders often say, my door is always open, but we're not aware of what that space means, that it's still a place where it's clear where authority and power sits. So what tips could you give us on the design of the context for conversation in a work environment?
Oh, that's by the way, a great example of the terms you use kind of counteracting or being counteracted by the context that you're in. And that's just a great example. One of the things I really work with a lot is the notion that scripts are already embedded in the spaces that we have. So, and actually when we name certain kinds of convenings or gatherings, we actually sometimes see spaces, right? So if I say board meeting, you'll probably have an image in your mind of what that board meeting looks like. And it's probably not a bunch of people sitting on the grass outside on the lawn, right? It's like, it's probably something different. And so one of the things that I really ask people to do is begin to spot scripts in their space. So your example of like the CEO's corner office where the door is already open is like, that is a script, right? There's a script to the space that just opening the door or closing the door doesn't change. You have to actually think about getting rid of that space altogether to think about the change, or having the CEO walk out of their office and kind of like, you know, so it's like you need to spot the script so you can say, wait a second, this space will never allow this script to be changed. A lot of that has to do with the fact that our brain uses space to build memories and mnemonics. So if there was an office that everybody gets fired in, which often in workplaces, there's like a place where people will always go when they get fired, you kind of don't want to go in that space because it's got bad connotations. And so really we need to look at like, what are we holding and what are the scripts that we hold and how do we actually kind of break them when we want to break them and how do we use them when they're valuable to us? And sometimes those scripts are really valuable to us. So yeah, I super geek out on the context thing. And the idea of like the idea of getting people to really recognize the scripts that are embedded in spaces all the time that we just don't see.
The fifth C is constraints. And I really love the example of brainstorming that you give at the beginning of the chapter where you talk about that for brainstorming to work, it has to be a free sharing of ideas without criticism. And that's of course, an example of a conversational constraint. So what are some other examples of constraints that people might need to set when we think about these kind of conversations in our professional settings?
Yeah, no, and that's actually, that example is a really interesting one because one of the things I think people do terribly when they actually explain brainstorming rules is that they don't clarify, which the original builder, like the original designer of brainstorms in the 40s, basically said, hey, critique will happen. It's just not going to happen in this session. So one of the things that people often kind of get really angry at with brainstorming is that they're basically like, wait, this just seems stupid. Like this is not the real world, where you're basically saying like, it's not the real world for an hour. And then we get to go back, you know? So I think it's kind of also, I really believe we need to explain the rules, explain the context, explain the constraints and why they're there. I think we talked about one, which is critique. One of the kind of the most important conversations we have where we need the most rules or the most constraints around it that we often don't do and really need to be doing. Sometimes those rules and constraints have to be set collectively before you can go into them. Certainly any significant cultural conversation about a hard topic, I think going back to the office, the example you used, it's like, how often do we set rules for how those conversations happen so that we can actually feel like we're doing them, where we can in a place where we can really kind of speak to it. I'll give you a sneaky constraint that I love, which is the agenda. So an agenda is basically a set of rules for the conversation and what you expect out of a conversation. And we often don't design an agenda. We just are like, we're going to start, we're going to have the conversation, we're going to make a decision, we're going to go forward. Whereas like, if you really design what happens in say a 60-minute session, do something like build in a time for quiet writing 2/3 of the way through, you can start to get really interesting constraints, really interesting rules into a conversation very sneakily. So the person who owns the agenda owns the conversation. I just think often they don't think of it as a creative act, as something that they can actually apply creativity to.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredibly, incredibly helpful. And I think that is so true. And I think for all of us, when we have meetings that matter, I mean, which I guess most of our meetings shouldn't in some shape or form, that we can actually use the practice of creating an agenda as a way to create creative constraints. And I think another thing that I think about is becoming clear on purpose. I think so many times we go into things, but we haven't defined the why. And I'm thinking that that's a constraint in itself, in a sense of being clear on why are we having this conversation and what, where do we kind of want to be? What do we want to feel like as we're going out of it?
I agree with that. And I think that that's kind of goes back to the thing that I was saying in the very beginning of the podcast, which is like, I'm very interested in places where people decide that they shouldn't be in a conversation, because that actually can help a conversation when you're like, I don't need to be in this one because I'm not going to be that helpful. So I think it's like a why of the conversation and then why me in this conversation? What are the doors that I don't have to open? What are rooms that are better off if they are having the conversation and they're doing it without me in those rooms? Which also, Tobias, gives us more time and more kind of control over what we do in our lives.
Okay, awesome. So the sixth C is change. And you use in the book the story of a pilgrimage going on a journey where we expect to be transformed. And how have you seen change happen through creative conversations in your work in an organizational context?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give you a really quick cheat on what I think is actually important with change, which is that change, the hardest thing with a change, and that could be a change of a mindset or a change where suddenly an idea has kind of taken hold in a group of people, or a change where suddenly an idea has been rejected by a group of people, is that when that change happens in a conversation, when suddenly everyone's in agreement for a moment, or suddenly actually, let's just stick with that one. We're not good at noticing that. So a change like that will happen. Wait, everyone's in harmony for this moment. And instead of seizing that and saying, wait, a change just happened, let's build off of that, we just let that slip by. So our greatest kind of, the greatest thing that holds us back from doing things is not noticing when changes happen in the room. So a cheat that I have is looking for people who are really good at spotting change. And those are people who are very good at watching a room. They might not be good at facilitating, they might not be good at talking, they might not be at whatever, but they can see when things have changed and have them really be there to be a change spotter. Watch when change has happened. So there's a lot of ways you can design change into a room, or you can make sure that we see change. I think the easiest is find somebody whose job is only to be change spotting. And then put, so that you can basically say, wait, everyone's in alignment for this moment, let's grab this moment, as opposed to letting it slip through, which we so often do. And without recognizing change, we just don't progress. We just don't move forward.
Wow. That's so interesting. And I think it's so true that we so easily don't see what is actually happening. And in those moments where there is a shift, where we, like you're saying, suddenly we're becoming aligned, or suddenly we're coming clear on something. And so the seventh C is creation. And you write about analysis paralysis, and that having in-depth conversations might make it harder to take the next step because there are so many options to consider. And that's actually, as we talk a lot on this podcast about ethics, that's of course, and speaking up, that's of course an issue there as well. You get so much more data kind of on the table, which in one sense makes it harder to make decisions. So how do we make sure that we don't get stuck?
This is actually a chapter that I actually wrote at the very end of the book. And what I began to recognize as I was writing it was just how circular these seven C's were, in the sense that actually I think that one of the things that helps us build commitment to each other, build connection, is often just making something together. So one of the things that we see often is like, if you can't speak, then cook something together. You know, if you can't like learn something from each other, then build something together. Like that's an incredibly powerful tool, and it builds community. It builds like that kind of culture when you make things together. So it's actually a cheat in the places where you can't find ways to have conversations to think about kind of making kind of like how you actually kind of create together. But it's also, I will say that the book was based on this, which is that so often people get together and they don't get to where they want to go. They get to like the next most obvious step, or they get to just defining terms and no further. And honestly, we need to be creating much more significantly than that. So we need more ambitious goals. One of the things I talk about in the book is time limits. Like what happens when you give yourself a day to do something as a group versus give yourself a year to do something for a group. One thing I'll do with board meetings is have boards figure out what their issues are, what the pain points of an organization are within 5 minutes, not do it over 3 hours. And it's amazing how fast you can use that to kind of start to kind of understand what you need to solve for, and then begin to create towards that in an interesting way. So it's a surprisingly powerful tool. Like society has been built on people sitting, making something together in the room, but having a conversation while they're doing it as well.
Fred, thank you so much for sharing all this wisdom. And I really hope for our listeners that you all can see and feel that, yes, there are things here that I can take and integrate in my conversations. And I believe that is true for so many who are listening to this podcast, as leaders, as HR professionals, ethics professionals, consultants, that there are a lot of conversations that you can actually design, and that you could choose to be more intentional in designing, and see that you actually have a powerful tool in your hand, and where you can step into something that would make you move forward in a totally different way than what you've experienced before. So thank you so much for that, Fred. And as a final question, just want to ask you, how can our listeners connect with you and follow your work? And again, just want to say, grab Fred's book, Making Conversation. It is a really, really helpful read, and you'll get to dig down much, much deeper into all these principles and see so many great examples. So how do people connect with you, Fred?
You can go to my website, dustand.co, which is my website, and see there. And then I would say that, honestly, I'm finding my most favorite medium now is LinkedIn. And if you just like look at Fred Dust on LinkedIn, it's where I put most of my articles. It's where we do a lot of our kind of more creative things. It's weird. I'm not loving other ways of connecting at this point. It's a hard time.
I'm with you on that. So thank you so much, Fred, for taking the time.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. It was really delightful.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.